exciting week for us. Without any further ado, let me go ahead and introduce Richard Clark, who is the Cyberspace Security Advisor for the President, and give you a few introductory little background on Mr. Clark. Mr. Clark has served in several senior national security posts. Most recently, he served as National Coordinator for Security, Infrastructure Protection, and Counterterrorism at the National Security Council. In the George H.W. Bush administration, he was Assistant Secretary of State for Politico-Military Affairs. In that capacity, he coordinated the State Department's support of Desert Storm and led efforts to create a post-war security architecture. He was a member of the NSC staff throughout the Clinton administration. And in the Reagan administration, Mr. Clark was the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Intelligence. Mr. Clark is a graduate of the Boston Latin School, the University of Pennsylvania, and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. So with that, I'd like to invite Mr. Clark up. How about a round of applause?
Thank you. Good morning. I'm just, as I was walking up, wondering how long it's going to take you to change the symbol, which I'm sure is connected to the wireless network. Don't take that as a challenge, but we'll see how long it remains up there.
When I come to Las Vegas, feedback.
Let's try it again. When I come to Las Vegas, I never quite can put my finger on where I am. It seems to me that I'm either in a scene from Blade Runner, or a scene from Matrix, or somewhere in a Fellini movie. It's a little bizarre place for us to be having conversations about security. And it's not the only place that believes that security on the internet is achieved by disconnecting yourself from the internet. Caesars is not the only place that tried that. A federal judge in Washington decided in a case last year that the U.S. Department of Interior had such poor cybersecurity that the only way to achieve cybersecurity was to disconnect it from the internet. And so he issued a federal district court order causing the entire Department of the Interior to be disconnected from the internet. And that had certain unintended consequences, like the Pacific Ocean Tsunami Warning Center was cut off from anybody who wanted to access information about tsunami warnings. We have to be careful about unintended consequences and simple solutions like disconnecting from the internet. This is a bizarre place and a fun place, but I guess it's my duty, being the top Fed here today, to be a little bit of a buzzkill. Things have happened since most of you were here last year. Things have changed. And while we're all here in Las Vegas having fun, we really need to remember that we've got thousands of Americans in Afghanistan getting shot at, hunting down Al-Qaeda, tens of thousands more in ships off the coast. We've got Coast Guard and local police and FBI, Secret Service all across this country doing long overtime, protecting the Brooklyn Bridge and protecting other landmarks. Although it may not look it, except when you're at an airport, this is still a nation at war. It's been a nation at war now for almost a year. And it's a different kind of war, as the President said last September. It's a war where we can't all just volunteer and go off to the front, as our parents and grandparents did. But it's a war nonetheless. And we have done, I think, a very good job of picking ourselves up off the ground after September 11th and defeating the Taliban, smashing Al-Qaeda. They're not completely smashed yet, but they will be. We've done a very good job of beginning to secure the infrastructure of the United States, which was pretty insecure. But the question I think we need to ask ourselves when we think about what a great job we've done since September 11th is, why does it always have to be that we do a great job after we've been hit? Why is it that our history shows us great things like the American response to Pearl Harbor? It took us 4 years, but over the course of 4 years, we responded, the whole nation got involved, we responded to Pearl Harbor. And our parents and grandparents crushed the enemy that would have changed the world. We did a great job in the late 1950s when we suddenly woke up and discovered that the Soviet Union had gotten into space before us. And the entire nation, all the scientists, all the engineers, the government, the military, threw themselves into the space race. And we won it. We got to the moon first, which was the measure of success. So we're very good as a nation of picking ourselves up off the floor after the fact, after the Japanese bomb Pearl Harbor, after Al-Qaeda blows up the Pentagon and the World Trade Center, after the Soviet Union gets into outer space. We always come back. We're resilient, and we always succeed. But why is it that we have to wait for the disaster? Why is it when the indicators of our vulnerabilities, the indicators of our enemy's intent are there, why do we have to wait? That's the question that President Bush has asked us with regard to cyberspace. Is there a way that we can, before there is a major crisis, before there is a major national attack, is there a way that we can begin to secure our cyberspace? What I'd like to talk about today is the strategy that we're developing, and give you a sort of exclusive preview of the strategy to secure cyberspace that will be unveiled in the middle of September in Silicon Valley. The national strategy has been a process. Earlier this year, we asked experts from throughout the country, what would you like to see addressed in a national strategy? When it goes online in September, what will you look for? What question will you look to be answered? We want to be sure that everyone had a shot at telling us their major concern. We began with 21 questions, and we distributed them around the country, and we got a few more back. We ended up with well over 200 questions, which we boiled down into 53 clusters of questions. And we've, I hope, addressed all of them in the strategy. We've also had town halls across the country where people from the metropolitan areas where we held the meetings were welcome to come and tell us what they thought the issue was, tell us what they thought the policy should be. Those town halls will continue after the cyberspace security strategy is released in September. There are six more scheduled around the country for later this year. Because the national strategy is not meant to be a point in time. It's meant to be a roadmap. It's meant to be participatory. And it is meant to change over time as the threats change, the vulnerabilities change, as the technology changes, and as we realize that the first time around, we got it wrong on some aspect, because chances are we will get it wrong on some aspect. And so the strategy will come out periodically, probably several times a year. It will be updated. It's a living document. And it's not a document written by the government, by a bunch of bureaucrats. It is a document now running some 2,800 pages that has been written by the experts in the fields. And so the chapter on banking and finance, securing the cyberspace of the banking and finance industry, has been written by people working on just that, people in the private sector working on securing banking and finance. There are chapters on the chemical industry, on the insurance industry, on oil and gas, on electric power, telecommunications, IT, and universities, securing the network systems that run on universities. There will be, in subsequent editions, additional sectors of the economy writing their strategies. We're looking forward to getting contributions from the healthcare industry, which hasn't yet contributed, and other sectors of the economy. But the goal here is that all of these sectors write their own strategies. that they get together and they address the issue. Because the federal government doesn't have all the solutions. What our job is to tell people there's an issue, to give them all the information we have, and to encourage them to develop in their own sectors of the economy solutions unique to their sectors. And that's what I hope you will see online in middle September when we look at the national strategy. The overall philosophy of the strategy is that all of us depend in some way on some part of cyberspace. Depend on. We can't do our jobs, we can't live our lives the way we do without cyberspace, without the electric power grid, without the ATM machines and the stock market, without the aviation system. All of that, in turn, relies on, cannot work without, cyberspace and the networks that run in it. So the strategy's philosophy is that all of us depend upon part of cyberspace, and each of us has an obligation to help to secure the part of cyberspace that we depend on. That's a simple idea, but it's a powerful idea. It's a powerful idea, and it's not one that is being implemented today. There's a lot of people in our country who are relying on cyberspace, who are involved in manufacturing products for cyberspace, or selling them, who are not taking responsibility for securing their part of cyberspace. Let me go through five audiences, five different types of people who have a responsibility to secure their part of cyberspace. I'm not going to tell you what we're going to recommend in the strategy, but I am going to suggest what the problems are that we want to address. Let me see if you can guess the first group. The software industry. The software industry has an obligation to do a better job in producing software that works. It is no longer acceptable that we can buy software and run software on sensitive systems like the stock market, like the banks, like the electric power grid, that is filled with glitches. It is no longer acceptable that every year the number of identified vulnerabilities goes up. CERT, CC at Carnegie Mellon, tracks the number of vulnerabilities, and they report that already this year they have exceeded the number of vulnerabilities identified last year. There are some things that you don't want to go up, and that's one of them. Now, I understand that in the process of curing the problems that we have with software, we are going to have to identify the existing vulnerabilities. And my view is that is something that we all should participate in. We should not just assume that the companies that produce the software are going to find the vulnerabilities for us. So, in securing cyberspace, in participating in each of us securing the portion of cyberspace we depend on, some of us, like you in this room, have an obligation to help find those vulnerabilities. What do you do when you find one? I think the responsible thing to do is, A, to report it to that company. Now, if they don't do anything with it, or if they don't do anything with it fast enough, then I think you have an alternative. You can report it to someplace like CertCC. You can report it to the federal government. Trust me, if you report it to us, we will also talk to the company. And maybe we'll get a better response. But it's not the responsible thing to do when you find a vulnerability to let everybody in the world know about it before the patch is developed and before the patch is distributed. And speaking of patches, one of the major problems the software industry has is the patch management system. As most of you know, the five vulnerabilities that the NIMDA worm went after were all vulnerabilities that had already been identified, already posted, patches had already been made available, and yet NIMDA was able to rip through Wall Street, among other places, and do what we now estimate to be over $3 billion worth of damage in 1 week. Not because the vulnerabilities hadn't been identified, but because the patches hadn't been applied. Now, who are we to blame for that? Well, the easy answer is that we're to blame the systems administrators who didn't apply the patches. But I think it goes beyond that. It goes to the very system the software industry runs, where they distribute a patch and they say, we've tested it, we think it's efficacious, go put it on. No systems administrator will do that. Every systems administrator will want to know, how does it affect the applications and the other operating systems that I'm running on my network? And she therefore will wait until the end of the month when there's a long weekend and there's downtime, and she can try that patch on her system. That's why NIMDA was so successful. Not because the systems administrators didn't intend to put the patches on, but because they hadn't had a chance to test them themselves. Maybe we could ask the software industry not just to tell us that the patch works on its own applications. Maybe we could ask the software industry to tell us whether or not it works on all the other applications, the top 10 or the top 100 applications that most companies are running. Is that too much to ask? That the industry should cooperate? That the government perhaps should cooperate with the industry in setting up a way in which we can test patches, not just against the operating systems or applications for which they are designed, but also against the top systems that are running, so that when a systems administrator gets the patch, they'll have a better idea whether or not they can put it on. That sounds like a minor idea. It sounds like something that's down in the weeds, but it's a major problem, since most of the successful hacks that we've identified are hacks using well-identified vulnerabilities for which patches have already been developed. We also need an improvement in the quality of software engineering. It is obvious, because of the vulnerabilities that we're identifying day in and day out, that the process of developing software is not working. The quality control obviously isn't there. Now, Bill Gates in January said he was going to fix Microsoft's process. Every time I mention that, I get the same reaction, little ripples of laughter throughout the audience. My reaction is not to laugh when Bill Gates spends $100 million in 4 weeks on a problem that we are all concerned about, when he tells all of his employees to change the way they do business. My reaction is to say, that's a step in the right direction. Now let's see whether it actually works. Let's see whether that commitment actually results in more secure products. But I, rather than rejecting Bill Gates' statement that he is now going to make security job one, I welcome it, and I'm going to hold him to it. And I think we all should not only welcome it and hold Microsoft to that pledge, we should ask other software companies if they're going to make a similar pledge explicitly, that security is now job one, that all functionality is dependent on the security functionality, that security is going to be designed in from the ground up, that things are going to ship out of the box with their functions switched off, and people can then turn them on, knowing the security implications of doing that. There's another group that I think we need to talk about, the second group, those who are responsible for Wi-Fi LANs. I was walking through the Chicago airport a week ago Sunday and picked up the Chicago Sunday Sun-Times and discovered the headline, "Are Your Wireless Secrets Safe? Wireless Systems Are Not Secure." Duh. 3 pages in the Sun-Times telling us the results of their war driving around the loop. Guess what? They got into law firms. They got into commodity brokers selling on the commodity market in Chicago. They got into a federal district court judge. On and on and on. You can do that not only on Chicago's loop. You can do it in Wall Street. You can do it on K Street in Washington. You can probably do it in any city in America. Why is that? Why is it that companies have sold products that they know aren't secure, or that they know are so hard to secure that no one will ever do it. Why is it that people have bought them and applied them in operations as sensitive as commodity exchange and law firms and federal courts? Why is it that they don't know? Or why is it that they don't care? I think the second group we need to talk to then are the people who have wireless LANs, the people who sell wireless LANs. Yesterday, John Stenbitt, the CIO for the Defense Department, speaking at a conference in Washington at CSIS, said that he has ordered throughout the Department of Defense all wireless LANs shut off. And he has asked every systems administrator to begin on a daily basis monitoring war driving to see if anybody has turned things back on in an unauthorized way. If you ask me my opinion, until we have a better proven track record of security with wireless LANs, we all ought to shut them off until the technology gets better. And we have to ask, why in this culture of ours is our awareness of IT security so low that companies throughout the country have systems that are wide open because of wireless LANs? After they've spent thousands of dollars on firewalls and intrusion detection systems and IT security audits, they then plug in an open to everyone behind the firewall wireless LAN. That's a failure of ours. It's a failure of the U.S. government that we have let IT security awareness get that low, that people are doing that on a widespread basis. So the government has failed. But it's also a failure on the part of industry that they're selling products that make proprietary, confidential, privacy information open to anybody war driving down the street. Let's talk about another group, the third group, telephone companies and ISPs that sell broadband connectivity. Whether it's a cable modem or a DSL line, the numbers of American households that have broadband connectivity is rising at a surprising rate. Especially surprising when you realize they're charging you $50 a month. Nonetheless, millions of American households are getting connected and therefore getting vulnerable to identity theft, getting vulnerable to having their household machines turned into zombies for denial of service attacks. And when that telephone company or when that ISP has given them a broadband connection, giving them the possibility of being always on and perhaps even giving them a static IP address, have they told them that they're making them vulnerable? Have they told them that they need a firewall? I know of one major national ISP that offers a firewall as part of its package. Only one major national ISP. And I know of no phone company or no cable company that is doing it. And when you ask the phone companies and the cable companies sort of off the record, how is it that you guys are selling broadband connectivity without firewalls? The off the record answer is, well, firewalls would increase the price. Firewalls would raise the barrier to entry. We want to make it cheap for people to get online with broadband. They want to make it cheap for people to be vulnerable to be hacked. Seems to me that every phone company, every cable company, every ISP that is offering broadband connectivity ought to be offering with it not just a firewall, but a system that regularly updates that firewall and improves it. It's a bit like selling a car today without a seatbelt. We would never allow that today. It's a violation of federal law. It's a violation of state law. But it is not a violation of anything except responsibility to be selling DSL lines and cable modems without firewalls. And when we think about how cable modem companies, ISPs, telephone companies could in fact sell you as part of the service a firewall, and they could regularly update it, we realize there are other things like that they could be doing too. That for the average home user, not one of whom is in this audience, but for the average home user, it's kind of a lot to ask. You know, when you're caring for the kids and running off to the soccer game and balancing the checkbook and doing everything else in an active household, and you want to go online to buy the book, or you want to go online to email your daughter at college, it's kind of a lot to ask that you should also spend a couple of hours a week worrying about patches, worrying about updating the DAT file in your antivirus system, worrying about whether or not your firewall is up to date. When I talk to audiences of consumers and the average, quote, average home user, and tell them, you've got to update the patches in your operating system on a regular basis, you've got to make sure your antivirus program is up to date all the time, you've got to get that firewall for your cable modem and update that all the time, they look at me and say, I just don't have the time to do that even if I knew how. They're right. We should not force the average home user to go through all of that. The ISPs or someone else ought to offer them that service. Perhaps for a premium, but nonetheless, that service ought to be made available to the average home user. Now, in some ways it is today. If you spend a lot of time looking around, you can find ways of having the antivirus program that came on your laptop or came on your PC regularly updated. And the same with your firewall, and obviously now with XP, the same with your operating system. But it's not easy, and it ought to be easy for the average home user. We ought not to assume that everybody in the country who gets online is a geek. The fourth audience I think we need to talk about is the audience who are responsible for securing the mechanisms of the internet. Now you're asking yourself, who are they? That's the point. Who are they? Who is it that's responsible for the internet? The government kind of helped start the internet. Various government officials thereafter claimed credit for it. Vince Cerf never forgave them, but the government having helped or facilitated the birth of the internet has kind of walked away from it. Now, in many respects, that's a good thing, because trust me, if it were a government project, it would work even worse than it works today. But the question is, who owns the internet? Is it the Internet Society? Is it the Internet Engineering Task Force? And who are they? And who holds them accountable? Who holds them accountable for doing the right thing and doing it quickly? For a long time, people in the Internet Engineering Task Force have been talking about securing BGP and securing DNS. For a long time, we've been talking about IPv6 and talking and talking and talking. And yet, secure BGP doesn't exist. The DNS system is not secure. IPv6, whether it's the perfect system or not, is not widely deployed. This is what economists call the tragedy of the commons. Something which is owned in common, which clearly has no one responsible or no one accountable for it, falls into disrepair and disuse. Now, the internet's not falling into disrepair and disuse, but it is not secure. And we are piling more and more and more critical infrastructure functionality onto the internet. The electric power grid, the railroads, the banking and finance system, the stock market, stuff like that now depends upon the internet. And if you're in the stock market, you can secure your enterprise. You can make sure that your brokerage firm is secure. You can even make sure, as all the brokerage firms get together, that the stock market itself is secure. But what are you going to do about the internet? Where are you going to go? Who are you going to talk to about the fact that there are mechanisms of the internet that we've identified as having security problems? And every time the IETF meets, it talks about them. And yet nothing happens. I think we need to ask the question, is there a role for the federal government working in concert with academic experts and private sector experts to try to help maintain the health and security of the internet? Now, every time I say that, audiences get a little shudder and think, oh, he wants to control the internet. He wants to have the government running the internet. No. I don't want the government involved in controlling the internet. I don't want the government controlling or regulating the internet. But there's got to be a middle ground. There's got to be a middle ground where the government doesn't walk away. Having said we're not going to regulate it, and meaning it, having said we're not going to control it or play big brother on it, that doesn't mean we should do nothing. If anyone is situated to deal with the tragedy of the commons, with the internet, it is the federal government. And we need to take seriously our role of facilitating the deployment of means to secure BGP, to secure DNS, to proliferate the adoption of other secure protocols. And to ask the question, should we be developing new protocols? How do we maintain the stability of the internet when it goes from several hundred million users to several billion users? I think of Carl Sagan every time I say that, but there are going to be billions and billions of internet devices. As wireless systems proliferate, as homes and cars and devices throughout the office have their own IP addresses, as countries around the world get wired, as China, as one marketplace, connects with hundreds of millions, if not billions, of IP addresses, what is the effect on the stability of the internet? Is it written somewhere in code or law that TCP/IP and all of the great things that brought us the internet always have to be the way it works? Whose responsibility is it for thinking about the future health and stability of the internet? I think it's all of our responsibilities, but in particular, the federal government that started the internet, that helped facilitate its birth, has a continuing responsibility, without getting into control, to think about the growing health, the growing security, and the growing stability of the internet. The fifth audience I want to talk about is the federal government itself. And what is its role in securing cyberspace, or securing its portion of cyberspace? The president has proposed a Department of Homeland Security. And in that proposal, he has suggested that we take five organizations scattered around the federal government that work on cyberspace security today. FedCert, the Computer Security Division of NIST, the Critical Infrastructure Office from Commerce, the NIPC from FBI, the National Communications System, housed at the Defense Department, and bring them together as a center of excellence for computer security in the department, the new Department of Homeland Security. That's not to make that center a law enforcement entity. In fact, the law enforcement part of NIPC will stay behind in the FBI. It is to create a center where somebody is accountable, somebody is responsible for cyberspace security. Because today, those five organizations and several other organizations in the Defense Department and elsewhere in the government, when asked, whose job is it to worry about this aspect of cyberspace security? Today, they can all do this. That's the problem. And so the president has proposed as a key portion of the Department of Homeland Security that there be a new center of excellence for cyberspace security. And IPC will be a big part of that. CHOW will be a big part of that. FedCert. But we will now have one place where people know it's their job to worry about it. And they're accountable and responsible to the American people for doing that job. The federal government can also walk the talk. It's very good that I get up here and other feds get up in front of other audiences around the country and tell the private sector and others, you've got to do a better job on cyberspace security. When our cyberspace security in the federal government is so bad that federal judges are shutting off the Interior Department. And if you use that criteria, lots of other parts of the federal government probably ought to be disconnected from the internet. What are we doing about it? The president last year looked at the departmental submissions for the proposed FY03 budget, the federal budget that starts being spent in October of this year. And there were lots of problems that we had identified in federal departments. But the budget submissions from those departments did very little to address those problems. And so the budget submissions were sent back for the first time by the Office of Management and Budget to those federal agencies with a very simple message. Either put money in your budget to fix your IT security problems, or we will take money from your pet rock and spend it on fixing your IT security problems. No federal agency wants money taken away from its pet rock. And so the result is that the budget that went to Congress this year increases by 64% the amount of money that we're going to be spending on IT security of federal agencies and federal departments. We are beginning to walk the talk. Earlier this year, the Defense Department said that it will no longer procure products, IT products, that haven't been through the NIAP certification process. NIAP certification process, as many of you know, run by the National Institute for Standards, sets up 10 categories of IT products. And what DOD is now saying is if there is a product in one of those 10 categories, DOD offices and agencies must procure from that product line that has been certified. That's a big change. And we are considering whether or not we ought to extend that requirement to the entire federal government. The federal government has a lot of procurement power. And if it uses it properly, it will create a market force that will drive IT security. If you look at the next three fiscal years, FY04, 05, and 06, and you take into account inflation and the president's commitment to IT security, our current estimate is that over the course of those three fiscal years, the federal government alone will spend upwards of $20 billion on IT security. Think about it. What effect could that procurement have on the software and hardware industry if we said that the only things we're going to buy with that $20 billion are things that have been certified to be secure? There are things like that that the federal government can do. But this philosophy that each of us has some responsibility for that portion of cyberspace on which we depend, this philosophy affects every one of you in this room. Beyond working in your company or your government department on securing your own systems, there's something more that you can do because you understand these issues, you understand the technology, and you understand the risks that this nation is running in remaining insecure and dependent, insecure and dependent upon IT. Several weeks ago, HBO had a made-for-TV movie called The Gathering Storm. And it was the drama about Winston Churchill in the years in the 30s when he was out of office. He was a member of parliament, but he had no cabinet position anymore. And he was about to turn 60. He was almost bankrupt. He was feeling very down on his luck. But he was very much aware of what was going on in Germany and became very much aware through information provided to him by someone in the aviation ministry, became aware of what the Luftwaffe was doing. Germany was spending a lot of money on the Luftwaffe in violation of the treaty. Germany was developing new technologies for airborne combat, new bombers and fighters, and building a force which could only be offensive. And so Churchill would go every Monday into the House of Commons, speak to the Parliament at Prime Minister's question time, and he would stand up and ask a question about the growing threat from Germany and the growing vulnerabilities of England. And he would be heckled, because in Commons, when you stand up, you can be heckled. And so his own party would say, "Sit down, Winston. Warmonger. Scaremonger." And then he got his hands on the actual data about the German buildup. And so after weeks of being accused of being a warmonger and a scaremonger, he stood up in Prime Minister's question time and said, "Prime Minister, isn't it true," and he was clearly reading from a government document, "isn't it true," and he read out the figures about the investment in new technology and about the growing offensive threat from the Luftwaffe. The Prime Minister couldn't answer the question because he didn't know. He didn't know about the growing vulnerability of his country. But he went back to his office and called in the aviation minister and asked if it were true. And the aviation minister said, yes, it was true. The nation was growing vulnerable to new technologies being deployed by the Germans. And so to shut Winston Churchill up, the Prime Minister announced a small increase in funding for the RAF, for more training of pilots, for more procurement of new technologies, something called the Spitfire. Now, fast forward a couple of years. War with Germany has begun. Winston is now the Prime Minister. And the battle for Britain, the first air war in history, is taking place. And it's a near thing, night after night. But, by the slightest of margins, the RAF holds on. And Churchill says, never in history have so many earned so much for so few, or some good quote like that, which I've just botched. The point is that the margin by which the RAF won, the margin by which the RAF won was that amount of training and investment and procurement of Spitfires that the previous Prime Minister had agreed to just to shut up Winston Churchill, because he had been such a pain in the butt, such a nudge all the time, because he was well informed about the technologies and about the numbers and about the vulnerability. Think what would have happened to our history, to all of us as individuals, if Britain had lost the battle for Britain. But it won it by that narrow little margin. We all have responsibility to secure cyberspace. Those of us who have some understanding of the technology, those of us who have some credibility with others because we have an understanding of the technology and because we know about the vulnerabilities, you all have a responsibility to be Winston Churchill's, to be out there in front of any audience you can find, your department of the government, your corporate board of directors, your CEO, the public, the legislatures, being little Winston Churchills and saying, we are vulnerable, and we need to invest more money in training and technology. So if a cyber war comes, as come it will, we, like the RAF, will win that war. Thank you very much.